Welcome back to Nota Bene. Nate Freeman and I are so thrilled, as always, for this upcoming auction season to be joined by our friend and a real expert, Locke Kressler. How you doing, Locke?
Doing very well. Happy to be here. Happy to be in New York.
It's good to have you in New York. You've been bopping around?
Been going all over the city. It's a beautiful day out today.
It is.
Fucking gorgeous out there.
Managed to get up to Sotheby's today. Dragging my mom around to all the
auction
houses.
That's nice. Did you guys have a nice lunch somewhere?
We before you did, this? Just down the road. A very simple tomato salad lunch. It was great.
Love to hear it. Love to hear it. You were just up in New Hampshire this past weekend?
Yes, for my wife's 25th reunion at Exeter. So I was the husband of all weekend. It was fun, though. It was a good time. So, and then we managed to do Boston for a couple days before, which was nice, going to Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, which I've never done, ICA. So it was a really, really fun last couple
of days. The New Englander in me loves it. I mean, yeah. I'm glad you did it and I didn't, but I'm glad to hear it. Anyway, let's get into the reason for this season. We have a somewhat subdued, on some levels, May auction season coming up. Obviously, kind of headwinds in the art market generally have, I think, discouraged a lot of consigners. So it was, again, as we spoke about in November, another tough business getting season. And there weren't that many of the 3Ds. No big debt, divorce, or deaths. Really, there were, you know, a couple of name sales. Obviously, Rosa de la Cruz on the ultra contemporary and contemporary level, who passed away just mere weeks ago. The entirety of the de la Cruz collection has found its way over to Rockefeller Season for a named evening sale, and then with some other property from the collection scattered throughout the day sale. And Christie's had another named sale.
Mary and John Papa John collection.
Papa John collection, of course.
Probably the biggest one that they had there.
Yeah.
A couple other smaller estates, but I would say overall, each season for the last 3 years has been, you know, really the sort of the bull of each auction house has been Emily Fisher Landau, Paul Allen, the two-part Macklow auctions, the Thomas and Doris Amon, David Solinger, who was the former president of the Whitney, and Bass, more and more. Like, all of those estates were fantastic works coming to auction, very fresh. And without that, you know, each auction specialist has to go hunt for individual lots one by one. And that's been sort of the tricky thing, I think, this season.
Yeah, certainly. Although I wonder if on the business side of the houses, there's a little bit of relief. They didn't have to come up with any massive guarantee figures in a very challenging funding environment. Obviously, there are individual lots and some of those other names we spoke about are guaranteed, but at a lower level than the names you just spoke of. There were no massive lines of credit that had to be extended.
Yeah, because when you do a sort of whole collection, it is a little nerve-wracking because you are, you know, saddled with whatever either doesn't sell or whatever you have to sort of cut down right before the auction to actually get it over the line. And I think with some of these, I mean, I was actually quite surprised going through each auction catalog and realizing how little at a very high level was not guaranteed. Obviously all of that can change, you know, beforehand. And in some ways it's kind of nice to have a little bit more of that kind of naked feel where it does feel a bit more natural. You know, I think the last few seasons we've seen this kind of kabuki theater of the sort of very public private sale, taking place. But, you know, I would say most of these auctions, even if they don't have guarantees now, I've seen plenty of them penned as the auctioneer is taking the rostrum. So, you know, I think things will start to get covered up as we get closer to the sale dates.
Yeah, I imagine most consigners are feeling somewhat risk adverse and would be open to deals even at the last minute. And certainly the houses, the property they have guaranteed in-house would be, I would guess, happy to sell off some of that risk. But I think overall we can expect less fireworks, less spectacle, less bombast. I expect it to be fairly quiet in terms of like the headlines you read in the newspapers, the stuff out into the popular press. There's just none of the, you know, mega star lots coming up this season. We'll talk about a couple special things, but
like last season, I think there were three works that went over $40 million, and there's really nothing this season. I think like the general, like fine art and luxury sales at Christie's, Phillips, and Sotheby's, they're down by like 18% compared to this time in 2023, and 15% down from what that was in 2022. Again, that has a lot to do with these big collection sales. They've got a pre-sale total of $1,234 million. So, I mean, it's still a sizable amount, but it's a drop from what it's been in the past.
Yeah, and just I want to add context for our listeners. We're recording this a week in advance of the first sale. We are almost a week in advance. We're Tuesday right. before the sale starting next Monday. So anything we get wrong is because of world events exactly. that happened in the next fault. Several exactly. days.
It's not our fault.
Yeah. It's the unknown unknowns.
It's always my favorite being a Monday morning quarterback rather than reading a crystal ball afterward, you know, doing that, you know, it's, you know, coming into the sales and not, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but, and listening to this after the auctions always has a little bit of egg on our face, but yeah, it's fine. So.
It's good to be humbled. It's yeah. good to be humbled publicly. I have this lined up, at least on my screen, to go chronologically,
yep.
Beginning next Monday, the 13th of May, I believe, we're Sotheby's will be starting out with the new Now sale. Is that correct, everyone? Yeah. All right. All right, everyone at home, load up your computers. You can follow along with us. The new Now, which of course is Sotheby's kind of ultra contemporary wet paint sale that they bring and they've started to put on before the usual contemporary sale. This year, clocking in at a very reasonable 18 lots. It should be fairly zippy, one would think. Not so many new names. We have Justin Cogliat, a great painter that shows at Modern Art in London, as well as, I believe, with the Green Neftali Gallery here in New York. This will be his third lot to come up at auction. He's really... That is not counting charity auctions. Thank you, Nate Freeman. What a deal. So this is the third up. Last one went for a world record for the artist of a little over $780,000, and this clocks in with an estimate of $200 to $300 US. So a nice sensible estimate for, I mean, if you can call that a sensible estimate for an artist that's relatively untested by institutions. But I love these paintings. I happen to be a big proponent and fan and involved in the market. I don't think any passions have cooled other than the overall cooling of passions. So, I would be somewhat surprised to see this reach a new world record. And then we're followed by some slightly more familiar names. Najeki Crosby has a painting that is coming up at auction for the second time. It last sold in May of 2017 for just a hair above $1 million off a $600,000 to $800,000 estimate. And it finds itself now on the block at an estimate of $2 to $3 million US. And then a really, really nice Kerry James Marshall painting. Fresh to market in that it's never been at auction before and is being sold by the person who originally acquired it from Jack Shaman in 2005.
So Kerry James Marshall obviously has sold at much higher prices for very large works, the record being $21 million. Sold to Puff Daddy, wasn't it?
I believe it was Puff
yeah,
Daddy.
Yeah, Puff Daddy, yeah. That was in 2018. The last work from the Vignette series, number 5, sold for $970,000 at Sotheby's in May of 2016. I actually have quite an affinity for these because my first day sale when I moved from New York to London, Amy Capalazzo was my savior and kept sending me great property, including a painting from this series, which was number 7. So that came up in June 2008, same size. And at the time, it was the second highest price paid, and it was $217,000. So if you think about that, I mean, it's not that long ago. So it's a huge jump up in terms of a $7 to $10 million guaranteed estimate. But yeah, really, really great work. I also thought I might get, I was being very experimental in my cataloging and the way we were doing the layouts, and I actually ended up cutting out some of the hearts from it and then extending it onto the side of the page. And after it went to press, I think there was a good 2 weeks where I was convinced I was going to get sued for copyright infringement.
Or even just a nasty phone call.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, completely. Yeah, yeah.
Lucy Bull, who's a fairly young artist, she has a show opening this weekend in Los Angeles at the David Kordansky Gallery. This kind of West Coast abstractionist movement. I really, really like these. I really like Lucy. She's a great person. Super fun, super smart and engaged. We'll see how this does off an estimate of $500,000 to $700,000. Nate, you introduced me to
That's
Lucy
true.
For the first time. What was the name of that wine bar that I really like on the east side of Los Angeles?
Yeah.
El Prado, the place is
She
cool.
has a work in the bar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Great bar. And restaurant, I guess, like
snacks,
wine bar, they have
olives,
food,
cheese,
snacks.
Shout out Nick Fisher, the owner of the bar. I don't think he's ever been shouted out on this podcast, especially not in an auction contest.
And Nick, definitely not. And I guess we'll know how his fortunes lie depending on how this lot does. You have people knocking on his door now, Nate. And then our friend Avery Singer comes in with a really, you know, not my favorite practice, but a very bold, great work. Looks great in the viewing at $2.5 to $3.5 million.
In her show in 2014 in Berlin, that I believe is the same show that the first work to come to auction was from, that sold to Larry Gagosian at Sotheby's. This was probably sold primary market for around $35,000.
Crazy. And well, you know, there are 8 pictures in the auction record that have sold at or above the low estimate of this picture. Of those, only 2 were in the last 12 months. So I'm wondering, again, if there's still appetite with this level, although maybe there's so many serious people invested in this market that this is simply what they trade for now. We'll see. Again, I would be slightly concerned about this picture. I, again, didn't check to see if it was guaranteed, to see if that concern is warranted.
I think not.
And as of right now, it does not have any financial guarantee, at least showing up online here. We'll see if that changes in the coming days. I would be personally a little bit nervous about that. It's not a market I follow super closely, but it feels toppy at that estimate. And then the contemporary art evening sale, which immediately follows that, hopefully close to 7 o'clock starting time. I don't believe that. over-under's on 7:30, but we will see. Also, we're not sure who will be taking the rostrum, if Ollie will take this second sale, both sales, or neither sale.
Yeah.
I didn't see him in the sales floors as of yet, so I'm not sure if he's in
New York.
I
think Michael McCauley took the...
So he's been taking the new Now sales the
which
past
has been
few
great.
Seasons.
Yeah.
And he's really, really,
really
good. I had a couple, you know, I remember at one point he got his first pair of white gloves handed to him by Ollie.
We discussed
a few seasons ago.
My bow tie in Dallas before on the podcast. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's a friend of the pod. He's a friend of the pod. But for the contemporary evening auction, I don't have as many notes on this because there aren't as many markets that I track closely. But I'm wondering, Locke, what stood out to you in the sale?
The first thing that kind of jumped to mind was the David Hammons body print. I mean, I personally love these works. They don't come up very often. There was a similar sized work that came up in May 2022, which made $1,381,000 against an estimate of $600,000 to $800,000. And, you know, we've seen this kind of the prices slowly sort of ratchet up higher and higher. This work was actually purchased 5 years ago in May 2019 at Christie's. At the time, it sold for $879,000 against an estimate of $400,000 to $600,000, and was at the time the second highest price. For any work by the artist. So now it's in at 1 to 1.5. So we'll see, not guaranteed. And I think, you know, many of these things I believe will probably change closer to the sale in terms of their guarantee status.
I love this picture. I would love to have it.
Yeah, absolutely. Another big one that jumped out to mind is the Andy Warhol and Jean-Michel Basquiat Untitled collaborative work. It's a very large scale painting, beautiful, probably one of the best of that series, just from the physical imagery, the amount of painting, the amount you see of both artists. It's coming at the gates with a $15 to $20 million estimate, which to me seems fairly aggressive, considering that the highest price paid for one of these was in 2014 at $11,365,000. If it sells, it's already a record price, even if it comes down with a little bit of room. It's not guaranteed. The work was originally purchased in 2010 at Sotheby's New York. They paid $2,658,000, so they've got a little bit of room to work on that if they need to come down.
Reserve.
But a big, you know, big and uptick in 14 years.
Unless I'm mistaken, I don't see the full listing here, but I believe this was exhibited in the show at LVMH.
It was at Fondation Louis Vuitton in 2023 and Brand Foundation as well, yeah.
It's not Peter.
I don't know that it is.
A lot of, obviously, you know, a lot of work from the LV show came to the Brand Foundation. A lot of loans in that show. We have no idea if it's Peter.
And then... in terms of other things, I would say there's a collection of Joan Mitchell's work, which, you know, looks quite beautiful in the presentation that they've made, just kind of spanning all of these decades. They're all guaranteed with third-party backing bids. four works in the collection, sort of, I think, four for a combined total of $36 million. And it's been kind of crazy in the last few years because we've just seen this trajectory of higher and higher prices for her work, very well deserved. But, you know, spanning from early works, I think her highest price paid was last year at $29 million for a 1959 painting, and then also a $28 million result for a 1990-1991 painting. So we're seeing, you know, just these very sort of pushed values for works across the spectrum from the 50s all the way to the 90s, so right before her passing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of works to load up one after the other. I mean, guaranteed as a group, is that the understanding?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. It's got third parties on it, so it's not Sotheby's problem, but yeah.
Maybe it's not their problem. I hope they didn't guarantee it if they weren't happy to own it at that price. And then I think, I mean, it bears special notice, Lucio Fontana, Concetto
Speciale.
Thank you. I knew someone would correct me. I love this piece. I've obviously spent a lot of time with it. It's publicly acknowledged to be coming from the Rachofsky collection. I've seen it there installed in Dallas. It's been in museum shows.
They purchased it in 2003 for $2.3 million. It was a record price for the artist at the time, though. So, I mean, these are quite rare, the Fina di Dio. It's the most coveted body of work by the artist. The top six works at auction are all Fina di Dios. And the record was set also for a yellow painting in 2015 at $29 million. So if you look at it in kind of the history of the market, it makes sense contextually for that estimate. I do feel, though, there has been a bit of waning in terms of the overall appetite. I was across the board, I think, the Italian market has taken a bit of a dip, and Fontana and Boetti seem to be the ones that were sort of bucking that trend. And in the last season, we've seen a little bit of, you know, shakiness in it. But the rarity factor, and frankly, this is, you know, just the amount of buchi that are in the actual composition are just insane. But I do, you know, there was a work that was coming up, a white one from, I actually won't say who it was from. I know they were, you know, the house Sotheby's was really struggling to kind of try and find someone to back it. So, and yeah, I mean, there's only 38 canvases that he made in this series. Wow. And a lot of them are in museum collections.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, this feels like such a special, special work that it could, despite the larger market conditions and artists and region specific, like I feel like this will do.
Yeah. This is
well.
Sort of an outlier in that capacity. Yeah. And I think adding the Rachofsky kind of Midas touch, I think that also helps. You know, I think that sort of seal of provenance is also very helpful for collectors.
There's not so many once in a lifetime opportunities this season. This feels like one of the few.
I also noticed, just to go backwards a little bit, was the Agnes Martin Earth 2, which is a beautiful large scale early canvas from 1959. It's currently estimated at $3 to $4 million. Because of my love for Agnes Martin, I'm bringing it up, but I also found it fascinating that if you look just at the literature, it does note Darrow's collection catalog. So obviously it's coming from the Darrow's collection. And if you look farther down in the sale, there's also the Warhol from 1961 called Carrot, also coming from Darrow's collection. So that was kind of interesting. They didn't name themselves, but they at least allowed the literature to show it was theirs.
There's enough breadcrumbs to get that. I'm not familiar with that collection or who it is.
Swiss collection, Schmidt-Heine. One of the most incredible sort of insane collections you've ever seen. So,
I mean, these are two very tasteful things.
Yes.
I mean, even the Andy Warhol is like,
yeah,
one of the more tasteful kind of black and white.
I mean, I can't get into what he sold when I was at Christie's, but some of the best, you know, Warhols and things that came up were from him. So, yeah.
And, to your knowledge outside of your time at Christie's, just in your general market knowledge, also still buyers as well as sellers?
Still buyers. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. At least for Agnes Martin's market, we saw obviously a huge price. It was one of the few things that had a real runner in the Fisher Landau collection, for that beautiful 1961 painting with the kind of gold leaf on it that set the record at $18.7 million. So again, you know, it's kind of within that context. I think, you know, I have such a passion for these early paintings. So hopefully, some, you know, minimalism has been a little bit down recently, but I feel like that's something that's very special.
But also this slightly earlier but very important body of work. I mean, it's really more of a connoisseur's market.
This is truly connoisseur, yeah. And then lot 113 is the Frank Stella Ifafa. You know, RIP Frank. You know, I get to work with him quite often at when I was working with Levy Gorvy, and you know, always just kind of great to be around. I've been up to the studio a bunch of times. You know, I was kind of going through pictures of me smoking cigars with him, and
oh wow,
real sad.
He loved a cigar.
He did, and his cars too. So we had a lot to talk about.
He lived a good life.
He did. He did.
He enjoyed his life. It seemed like.
I mean, and also, I mean, listen, he's also sometimes difficult as well. We had a show that I worked on for an entire year that was supposed to open in London. I think it was in. It was 2019, I think it was, or 2018, and we ended up canceling the exhibition 3 weeks before we were opening. So that was okay. Real fun. Yeah. But listen, I mean, I love Frank. He's such a character. He always had, you know, even when he was doing the Whitney show, I think he reinstalled the exhibition something like 45 times.
Oh my God.
So he's kind of got his own vision and the way to do it. And obviously, there's been some. This is a fantastic work. I'm pretty sure I know where it's coming from, but I can't note it. But, you know, it's really been in the same collection since, you know, essentially 1964. It's the, you know, and the second highest price paid was in 2023 for Honduras Lottery Company at Sotheby's. And that was $18.7 million. That was, you know, a barn burner of a painting.
Yeah.
I think this one's a little bit more subtle and beautiful, but I would hope that, you know, the right people would step in for something like this, especially if it's missing in the gap in the collection. So.
Yeah, I mean, I love looking at this in the view.
I love this.
Kind of the day after, 2 days after his passing had been announced, and it was special. Yeah, what a guy. What an American artist. Like, I know he spent a lot of time, like, you know, in his 20s in France and elsewhere, but, like, what an American artist. I read this great book about a group of artists, including Agnes Martin and Frank, that all lived kind of in the same group of buildings downtown in the late 1950s and early 60s, mm-hmm. called On the Slip. And it's mm-hmm. a great history of New York and about how geography informs artistic practice. Mm. And I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to read that, actually.
And I think he was so revolutionary. He was... You know, you can see this incredible arc, and actually the show I was putting together was a look back mainly from the concentric squares and how that sort of changed throughout his career up until the more recent sculptures. And what you see is he was always pushing the bounds, but way ahead of the time. So using computers and, you know, this sort of 3D model printing, but it was so advanced kind of for the time that I don't think people necessarily appreciated or understood exactly what, you know, he was bringing to the table until 10, 15 years later. Mm-hmm. I'd say one of the bigger lots that's coming up at Sotheby's this season is the portrait of George Dyer Crouching, the Bacon. It's estimated at $30 to $50 million at the moment. I don't believe it has a guarantee. It was recently shown in 2022 at the Royal Academy of Arts in the Francis Bacon Man and Beast exhibition.
Yep.
If you saw that, it was a great show.
Fantastic.
This one's been in the same collection for 54 years. So, you know, really fresh to the market. And obviously the subject being George Dyer, one of Bacon's, you know, greatest loves and muses. This work is from a group of 10 thematically unified paintings of George Dyer that were made between 1966 and 68. And this was actually the first from that series. Another one from the series was George Dyer Talking, 1966, which sold in February 2014, really at the peak of that kind of Bacon market, for $70.2 million. And interestingly, most of these works are from that series are in private hands still, barring the Thyssen and the Sarah Hilden Foundation in Finland. And one of them was destroyed in a fire as well. But
I love this painting so much. Yeah. The sheer ferocity of George's face and the way that sofa for me constructs almost like a bull ring with it containing this animal. And you get this kind of this feeling of motion and energy that's just arrested for half a second in the painting. And even in the brushwork itself feels embodied with that ferocious energy. I think right now at a moment when things are soft, there's tons of uncertainty. If you have the cojones, you can come in and my guess would be get this for what in 10 years will feel like an absolute steal.
Completely agree. I mean, it's got just, as you said, the most intense energy to it. It's got that sense of movement that you want in a bacon. And I don't know, it's, I think this is a really, you know, great, great work to be coming up and hopefully find a great home.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, you know, overall the theme for me of this season, and we won't get into the day sales, but it really extends into the day sales. You can get exceptional work. It's probably, my guess is, without too much competition, at prices that will prove to be incredibly attractive if you have the force of will, and if you are willing to invest in your own sense of taste and point of view, that will be proven prescient. Maybe in economic terms, maybe not, but certainly in the quality of a collection you can assemble using the auctions. I think now is the time when turning to auctions to buy is super, super smart.
Yeah. And I find a lot, I could see what the auction houses were doing in many cases, going after certain pictures off the backs of the November sales. So, you know, Agnes Martin, Joan Mitchell, and the Richard Diebenkorn, again, was another, you know, record price that was achieved in 2023 at $46.4 million. This is a beautiful painting, you know, from the Ocean Park series, which is, you know, highly coveted. A lot of the paintings aren't necessarily in the greatest condition. This one does not have a guarantee at $18 to $25 million. The last time the work came to auction was a record price at the time when it sold for $23.9 million. So there is this slight possibility of a haircut here if something doesn't go according to plan. But we've seen other Ocean Park type works sell as high as $27.2 million. As recently as 2021, from that one from the John Marion collection.
I mean, and this is the most desirable series by Diebenkorn, right? The Ocean Park?
Yeah, I mean, the one that came up and made the record price was just a very unique example. And interestingly, I figured out who bought it, and it made total sense with the orchestration of how the auction went. But I would say overall, you know, these are the most recognizable and iconic, I would say, from the artist. So that's what you kind of think of when you think of Diebenkorn. There's also that great Keith Haring, which is coming in at the 1986 painting, which is coming in at $4 to $6 million.
Painting's great.
Great.
You.
Yeah. And that one is guaranteed and does have a third party. This one, though, did come up previously with a lower estimate, similar to the Diebenkorn. It was purchased in 2021 for $5,779,000. At the time, it was the second highest price paid for Haring. Although it technically, I think, was the highest price that was actually paid for, because the highest price at the time was actually not paid for. but really killer work. And, you know, if coming in at $4 to $6 million, having the owner just spent $5.8 million, basically.
When was the auction that it went for?
2021.
I'm interested in the psychology of, you know, or maybe it's not even psychology.
I don't know if it's psychology.
It might just be raw economic need
exactly.
to part with this
Unfortunately,
work.
Unfortunately, yeah. That was kind of it. I'm sort of breezing through the sales. Let me know if there's anything else you want to sort of touch
nothing.
On.
I mean, this is just a personal, because I know it's not maybe the type of Roy Lichtenstein that the market really wants, but I love this purple range picture of these mountains. I just think in the right collection, it makes so much sense. And you get everything he's known for and everything that you not everything you want, because you don't get the comic book stuff, you don't get the pop culture stuff, but you get the Americana stuff, because
it
whispers it. It doesn't shout it. And I thought it was a picture that would appeal to you. And your
very much so. I mean, we did, I curated an exhibition in London, which was focusing on Roy Lichtenstein, Sigmar Polka, and Gerald Lang, who are three artists from three different countries who all kind of came to the Bende Dot at the exact same time. Mm-hmm. And it was just this kind of interesting zeitgeist that was happening. And this, you know, it's a very like quiet, poetic painting. And that's what I tend to like. I like both sides of it. I would love to have, you know, some crazy text
or
painting.
Something. Yeah.
But I think this in particular is just, you know, it's got, I could very happily live with this painting.
Yeah, it feels like a deal at that low end of the estimate to me.
Oh, completely, for 1966 painting
as
well.
Yeah, right. All right, moving on, the next evening we will head over, unless I have this out of order, which I could, because I'm not sure when Phillips is, but in my book, you head right on over to Rockefeller Center for Rosa's sale. Is that correct?
I believe so.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to make it correct. So as I said at the top of the pod, you have something like 26 lots in this kind of special breakout sale from the De La Cruz collection. And then other lots from that collection scattered throughout the day sale. And I think probably going into the next sales and seasons would be my thought. You know, obviously it opens with an artist that was, you know, the two artists that were nearest and dearest to Rosa's heart and form kind of the heartbeat and core of the collection, Ana Mendiata and Felix Gonzalez Torres, two artists that both had roots in Cuba as Carlos and Rosa de la Cruz do. So you have this great selection of kind of photographs, but the photographs that document performance and really earth, sort of earthworks, I would argue, by Ana Mendiata, that really dealt with her body, the feminine, and nature. Never have been super commercial. You get a kind of the full suite of works for $50,000 to $70,000. I'm not sure what this market is like, but it seems like to own a significant piece of art history, that's a minimal investment.
I think a lot of the things that are in the collection coming to auction are priced well, are priced appropriately in sort of today's market. And I think something like this, again, for connoisseurs, this is a fantastic thing to have. Yeah. In one's
I mean, I should be said, in full disclosure, I know this collection very, very well. I also realize what is missing from the public auction sales of what was included in the collection, and that I know has been marketed and sold in private transactions over the past 12
to
18 months.
Can you speak to any works in this sale that you were involved in? I don't know.
No, I definitely cannot. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just checking.
You know, there's one that's in the day sale. It's a great Wade Guyton's U sculpture that they acquired from Phillips a number of years ago. So okay. That's a public one that I can cop to.
You were selling things at Phillips. That's great.
and at Phillips at that time, that sculpture was in the evening sale. Wow. To be clear, I was selling evening sale things. I had to fight Michaela off for the De La Cruz's on that bid for sure. listen, there's a number of my favorite artists. Like, there's a great Doig is as good as maybe particularly one other Doig that they had in their collection, maybe not, but a fantastic, fantastic picture, a seminal Ana Mendiata sculpture. And of course, you know, the lead lot in terms of value, this Felix Gonzalez Torres light string, one of the large, unique light strings. From what I understand, the entire collection is guaranteed by the auction house, I believe. Because, you know, while there have been prices around this paid, this still feels right now for a very non-market driven artist. This is for a specific collector.
Very specific. Like, I mean, this isn't, you know, it's still big money here, but I think there are museums and collections that would kind of need to fill this gap. And this is a great opportunity with a great provenance to it. But, you know, I would say overall, if this collection, I hate to say it, had come up, you know, 5-6 years ago, it would have been bananas. But, you know, so many of the artists have sort of seen either a dip in their kind of overall market
or just less heat in general.
Yeah.
I mean,
I
think it is a big question on everyone is why the rush to market for this work.
Yeah.
There's no, what I would understand, there wouldn't be any estate tax implications because you know, a transfer to her to Carlos without a taxable event. So I'm not sure why they're pushing right now. Because this doesn't feel to me for most of these artists like their moment, but it is what it is. And I think it could mean there's lots of opportunity for people out there to get these things that a couple years ago would have been more. And I think if you believe in the artists, as I do in a number of these artists, like Wade Guyton, this fantastic example of Flaming You. I didn't do the ArtNet research, but I know that these were selling for at least $3.5 million back in the heyday for pictures of the scale and this quality. An even more solid Doig, this Rainbow Wheel. I mean, this is a fantastic painting. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of Doig in it. Great Mark Roach on mask. Some more Mendiata.
I love the Thomas Schutt installation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, really, that's really great.
Ooh, that's going to be a tough one.
Well, that's the thing, is it's all these things that I love, but don't translate necessarily into kind of any market presence.
But you're right. I mean, these estimates are very attractive across the board.
Yeah.
Sterling Ruby at this large scale for a Sterling Ruby with these colors in it is an incredible deal. Even right now in today's market, I know people are still spending up to $1 million on the right kind of Sterling Ruby spray paintings. Yeah. So at this estimate, that's a really attractive number.
It's got very... Part of it is a very Inigo aesthetic, but
well, yeah. I mean, something we didn't talk about with the wool text painting that's in the evening sale over on York Avenue. And I just see this this wool here. Have you been to see the great show that Christopher has staged down in the Financial District yet, Lost?
So my I'm a huge fan, and weirdly my mother is as well. So we were going on Monday, only to realize that it's only open Thursday to Sunday.
Oh, really?
So we're so we're going to go on Thursday or Friday.
I look forward to hearing your thoughts offline about that.
I mean, I've seen a million photos, but I've heard the experience, but I really want to see it.
A lot of these artists, you know, you could argue were indigoed, or somehow their market was softened by his involvement in it. I wonder if that's actual causation or just happened around, you know, sort of same time. But certainly Stingel, I mean, probably the market he was most known for pumping up and setting really strong prices for in the auction room is super soft. And you have a great silver carpet here for $600,000, and it's big.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's got a crispy screen on it.
It's a good painting, and it's crazy. But I think the problem with these ones is he produced so many of them that I think the market kind of woke up to finally like just how many there were out there when they were just popping up in every sale. Interestingly, Rosa bought a Stingel from one of our sales when I was at Christie's, and when they were trying to move it, a forklift went straight through.
Oh God.
Yeah.
That's a fun phone call.
Exactly. Fun phone call. Probably saved her some money, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but you know, still in the moment, that's not how she saw it. I almost guarantee you.
I mean, if I could write a book, it would be great.
Tell it to your therapist. I know I have. my absolute favorite painting in the sale is lot number 23, the Sigmar Polka. I've lusted after this painting since I saw it for the first time. It is an incredible, incredible artwork. I don't think the market agrees with me, but...
No, I mean, I have sold plenty of these sort of privately, and I absolutely love these. I have a complete passion for Polka's work, but I think, again, it's sort of one of these markets that just for some reason hasn't been able to kind of sustain itself to what it was, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago. So, but a really seminal example, I think, from this kind of polyester resin series.
That's all I have to really say about this sale. I just see opportunities stamped all over some of these things.
Yeah. And I think, interestingly, not only is it going to be opportunity from the price point perspective to be able to buy something, but I think Christie's is also going to want to try and cover as much as they possibly can for this, because it's not necessarily something, I mean, maybe other than the Felix Gonzalez Torres would be kind of, you know, something that they want to keep.
Yeah. And I do wonder how much, maybe not necessarily right in the moment, but in 10, 20, 30 years, how much the provenance will affect, you know, having a great ruby from the De La Cruz collection. If that will mean anything, I feel like it may, considering how important she and the family were to changing Miami and putting it and its art scene on the global map. And I feel like that's a name that will continue to ring out, maybe, if you have a picture that has that provenance attached to it.
Yeah, and also having kind of that first choice pick for a lot of these, and having sort of picked a lot of these very early on, I think that will sort of then hopefully transition once, you know, time will tell, but once, you know, 10 plus years from now.
And that will lead us right into the 21st century evening sale. They're giving it an hour for the first sale. I would say we're closer to 8:15, 8:25 for a start time on the 14th for the 21st century evening sale.
Make those dinner resis late.
Yeah. I think you 9:30 or 10 if you're trying to eat.
Yeah.
Maybe bring a bag lunch. what stood out to you in the sale, Locke?
I'd say lot 36 was the Basquiat. Obviously, major painting from 1982. It's, you know, 60 by 60 inches, estimate on request, which is around $30 million. I love the stretcher painting works. I love that kind of rawness to them. I would say of all the ones I've seen, this is definitely in that kind of top tier of paintings. It also takes with it a very, you know, strong estimate as a result. But, my sense is that, you know, for anyone who's kind of a great Basquiat connoisseur, that's one that's definitely going to stand out.
It's got the crown, it's got the face, it's got some fantastic text and super strong words.
I know who owns it, but I can't say.
I'll back up just a second. I'm not sure how well it'll do or not, but it's an exceptional Reggie Burroughs Hodges painting,
of course,
in the service of others. I feel like his market has stalled out a little bit, so I think within this estimate, it's an incredible deal, and like I would bid way in advance of this if it were my money. It's one of the best works by him to ever come up publicly from this early series.
Yeah.
a huge, huge, huge fan of this painting.
Let's see, sorry. Next I had the Tansy, which I thought was really...
Oh, it's so good. It's so fucking good.
I mean, it's an absolute killer.
Does anyone else care? Is this an active market or is it just for us dorks?
It's active, right? Wasn't there a record?
I mean, I have to say it was extremely active a few years ago, but it seemed to have kind of picked up since. You know, I think this is probably one of his most recognized images. Large scale. You know, I just love that kind of wet painting technique. It's Mont Saint-Victoire, which is the mountain that Cézanne was obsessed with. But then in another sort of twist on it is that it's all these bathers, which was another subject that Cézanne was obsessed with. And he's always got these kind of cryptic narratives. But what I love is, like, if you sort of turn the painting around, it goes from this kind of strange image of French soldiers kind of discarding their uniforms, going into the bathe, and then the flip side or the negative image where you think you're seeing a reflection is actually of women bathing. And the kind of mountain turns into a little bit of like a pit. It's such a cool picture. And I think you can kind of sit there and try and decipher it for hours.
Well, I mean, and that's what you look for in the best of his work, are these small visual tricks that he engages in, often having to do with reflections and reflections in bodies of water, or somehow turning where you can invert the picture and find a totally different picture. But it never feels kitschy or one-note-y. Perhaps that's because of kind of the wet-on-wet and sort of monochromatic painting style. I fucking die for these things.
Probably the other big boy that's in the sale is the Bryce Martin event, which has a in-house guarantee at the moment. It's been reported, so I can say, by Richard Schlagman, who's the owner of Fiden Press, great collector, really amazing eye. And he acquired it through Thomas Amon. It sounds like it was kind of like not a mystery, but a lot of people didn't really know this painting existed until it came out. and sort of part of that sort of Garden of Plain image, it's like a larger group that consists of two mural-sized works and with six paintings, one of which is in the MoMA collection, and then three diptychs, Extremes, which is in the collection of the Pompidou, and then the other one is Compliments, which came up and made a world record price for the artist. Compliments made $30.1 million in 2020. And it was the second highest price paid for the artist, so... the second highest price actually was Tout Léger, which was a $17 million one from the Maclo collection. So they've had some big numbers, but kind of coming in already at an estimate of $30 to $50 million. Like, if it bangs on at the low estimate, it's already a record price.
Cool. Great picture.
But it's a great, great painting. I love these works. And I also really like the Bruce Nauman. Oh, yeah. The Hanged Man. I mean, it's such a killer killer sculpture, but it's like... It's
not my favorite now, man.
But I find it's one of those works that would be... It's great to see in a public context, but it's kind of wild to think of living with it. It's one of those kind of sculptures where you feel like it should be in a museum collection. But this is also part of the John and Mary Papa John collection from Iowa.
Okay.
And he purchased that in 1987 from Leo Castelli.
Is he the Papa John's pizza guy?
He's not the Papa John's pizza guy.
That's too bad.
I remember when his name started popping up when I was at Chrissy's. I was like, I wonder if it is.
I remember the same thing at a different auction house.
A lot of crappy pizza buys you a lot of big art, but different Papa John. Another one of the works from that series is in the Daskalopoulos collection. And the record price for a neon is as high as sort of $9 million that was paid in 2021. But the Papa John collection actually has some pretty incredible works in it. Jasper Johns, Martin Puryear, Agnes Martin, Henry Moore. So it's got a kind of nice through line, but yeah, very, very astute eye. I was being somewhat, good about not going too in depth on a number of things, but the other one I love is the Selmans that's coming up, the sort of the spiderweb.
The people love it when you go in depth, Locke. This is all the feedback I hear. I'm not being facile at all.
No, it's funny because I always, when the podcast comes up and I look and I'm like, oh my God, it's an hour and 15 minutes long. Sorry, everyone.
We're going for four this time. People love it.
No, but I mean, the Selmans, I think, is, you know, an incredible web drawing. I have a real affinity for her work, and I'll mention it again later in the pod, but I think this is, you know, a seminal example, bought directly from a key gallery, been the same collection for almost 20 years, so.
Just saw Via hanging out at Matthew Marks Gallery. Oh, yeah. In the Charlie Ray Show. Pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
No, she's lovely. I had lunch with her.
Super nice.
But that was kind of it that was really jumping out to me.
Things just popped out to me just real briefly with the two Julie Moretti paintings in the sale. Obviously, she has a big show up in Venice right now. That wasn't really setting people on fire. There's one kind of early painting that I thought was exceptional.
The Fevergraph, yeah, I really like that one.
Yeah, yeah. That has a lower estimate at 4-6. I mean, it's a scale issue, but still, those still seem very desirable. The later work, which at least for me and like the buzz that I hear, not in the market, but from art aficionados, maybe look less strong, especially when you see them in an exhibition with the vintage work.
Agreed.
Has a larger or higher estimate, I should say, at 5-7. I'm not going to click through and see if it's guaranteed or not. I worry about how deep that particular market is. There's a good Martin Wong. I won't say a great, but a very good Martin Wong that I was attracted to. It's interesting to see Toma Apps in an evening sale at an estimate of, I think, like 200 to 300, mm-hmm. maybe. And of course, just in the early part of the sale, a Louis Frattino, who was featured in the curated exhibition at the Venice Biennale with like a full room of his works given up over at the Giardini? Yeah.
Giardini.
Oh, me and my Italian. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, you were just there for 2 weeks. Come on. Should have rubbed off on you.
I always hope that it will, and it never does. And also, I'm just seeing our friend and recent show guest, Chloe Wise, is the last lot in the sale.
I saw the work today. I thought it's really, really wonderful. And it was, you know, from the era when we all sort of met in New York. So I find it very, very lovely.
Yeah, I would love to. But I'm interested. I would love to know the backstory and how this particular picture ended up in this particular sale at this particular moment in time.
Yeah, in the evening sale context as well.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of buzz is going on in the market or what other picture it was attached to.
It's probably the only time that Eric Wareheim has been mentioned in the
Is he in the catalog? Yeah, the catalog. That's incredible. love to see it. That's great. Again, there's not...
his wine last night. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
It was really good.
All right. Heading over to my former stomping grounds to a sale that, and I oftentimes slag them off, I thought an incredibly strong-looking sale. Maybe perhaps because, unlike the other houses, it doesn't break out kind of the pre-war or even 19th century work. Like, it kind of is everything all at once in a relatively tight sale. And I was very impressed by how things looked over at 56th and Park.
Yeah, it's a very digestible sort of group. I like going to the views there because you can kind of easily get through. It's not, you know, 15 floors and all these tiny, you know, rabbit warren galleries. But I think they did a great job this season. I think one of the standouts to me was the Barclay Hendrix, the Vendetta painting. That's estimated at 2.5 to 3.5 and has a guarantee in third party. That was included at your home, University Duke, recently. Yeah, so it was Duke, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, Houston, for the big Barclay Hendrix Birth of Cool show that took place in 2008 to 2010. We've obviously seen big prices paid in the past. This is a smaller painting by comparison, but again, another record price that was paid in November for an artist at $8.3 million. So,
listen, if you have 2.5 plus BP and you don't try and buy this, there's something wrong with you. This thing is incredible.
Yeah.
Considering all the, I would say, second-rate representational painting over the past half decade in comparison to something like this, and thinking about the context and the time in 1977, I believe, that it was made with this particular image, the look on her face, the text on her tank top, like this has it all. This is, not only is it political and amazing, it's also so fucking chic.
Mm-hmm. And And it's fresh. I mean, it feels like something that could be very contemporary. That's the wild thing, especially with the sort of white t-shirt with the white background. You know, it's just, it's very sort of, I don't know. It's got all of these, as you said, very chic aspect to it, but it's also got a lot of power to it as well.
I love this painting. And probably the, you know, kind of, for my money, the second most interesting Basquiat anyway to come up this season. Untitled Elmar.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. So that's one of the bigger estimates that's taking place all week, with an estimate of $40 to $60 million. So it's got a guarantee and third party on it. Originally coming from Francesco Palizzi, who was the first husband. He was related to the co-founder of Dia, Filippo Dominio, and they ended up buying this from Anino Nose in the early 1980s. And there's two paintings coming up, one at 40 and one at 6.5 from the same collection, although it's weird how they do the provenance of it. One's coming from the family of, I can't remember exactly how they wrote it, but it slightly different provenance for both pictures. And then I noticed there's actually a third painting that's going to be coming up in Hong Kong. Okay. It was sort of strange because I got into the space and I was like, oh wait, I didn't remember seeing this painting.
Same.
I like walked up to it and I realized it's just a sort of Xerox copy of it on the wall. But so it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting. I think it's a smart strategy to try and break those three up, so it's not just in one sale. But you know, the freshness, I think it's a killer image. It's had, you know, a lot of, you know, exhibition history and things. So it's
I like this picture an awful lot. It would be hard for me to choose between this and the other one that's the other major picture that's up this season. That has more text, obviously, and is somewhat more in your face, has more coverage and less background, but like the full figure on the right hand side with that crown of thorns, I think, is just absolutely incredible. But have we seen, I mean, in my mind, I'm not so actively engaged, so it's mostly as a spectator, it seems as though the Basquiat market has cooled down considerably over the past handful of years.
I mean, I find I get lots of requests from, you know, your sort of standard collectors that we work with on a regular basis to very new clients. I think you've seen this sort of generational shift away from collectors who wanted to buy pop art, wanted to buy abstract expressionism, because it was sort of for a certain generation, much like what happened with Impressionist and modern art for certain sort of people. And when you're coming into money, when you were sort of, you sort of want to buy your time or buy your sort of era or slightly before, and Basquiat seems to tick a lot of the boxes for people who do have, you know, newfound wealth. It seems to be,
it feels more of the streets.
Yes, right? Yeah. But I think this is a great example. I love the sort of Xerox quality of the head, even though a lot of people kind of tend to shy away from them, because again, it was a new media to be able to use Xerox at that time. So it's, to me, it's got a really nice, strong, vivid quality to it that, you know, one would hope would do well.
I really don't like the other one.
The second one, I'm not a fan of. Like, yeah,
okay, let's just leave it.
Yeah,
be
exactly.
No reason to pile on.
They've actually, I'd say they've got a couple of good collections. So there was this collection and then the Sandra and Jacob Turner collection from Los Angeles. It's a state, longtime trustee of LACMA. Actually, his wife had received the title of lifetime trustee there. They have three works coming up. Frankenthaler, which is, I think, for me, an exceptionally strong example. They also have Jewel Litsky's Boyer Time from 1962 and Grace Hartigan's Mohawk Highway from 1957. I would say all three of those, you know, in my mind's eye, could do exceptionally well against the estimates that they've got. This painting was created in 1959. It then went straight to her first solo institutional show at the Jewish Museum, and then after that to her show at Andre Emmerich Gallery in 1960. And in 1959, she was also invited to participate in the second edition of the Documenta in Kassel, and then she also went on to win the first prize at the Premier Biennale de Paris that year. So it's, you know, there was a real sort of zeitgeist around her going on at that moment. And it was also sort of painted the year after she married Robert Motherwell. So, and when you go into the provenance of it, the previous owner was Steve Martin, which is, you know,
that's quite cool.
The eye. And it basically went from Steve Martin and to their collection where they bought it in 1995, which is, you know, totally fresh to the market. Frankenthaler has been, you know, there was this huge boom in her price. You know, you saw Crystal Bridges spend a huge amount on a large late painting. What I've noticed is really from the 70s and, like, I mean, the top six works, strangely, for her are from the 70s. Sometimes it's because it can be more expansive in terms of the canvas. But if you go from just the 60s and 70s, and try and find what the highest price was paid for a 50s work, it's the 26th highest price was for a 1950s work, which is kind of mind-boggling to me. It was back in 2015, and it sold for $2.4 million. It was titled Las Mayas. And I think this has some real position given the early dates, the rarity of having 50s works come up, or even, you know, early 60s come up. I think this has got some firepower behind it. And it's a beautiful painting to boot. So, and then I also feel very similarly about even the Elitsky, which is not sort of necessarily a household name that you see come up that often, but, you know, it's estimated at $400,000 to $600,000. It's, you know, quite, you know, his record was set at $774,000. And I think this could be a real contender. And similarly, Grace Hartigan's record was set 2 years ago for 1.3. You know, despite seeing some slight visible cracking in the surface, it's got a huge, huge wall presence. And, you know, I know people are very much looking for this slight rediscovery of great female painters from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So this seems, all three of those seem to be well priced and poised for a strong result.
It's cool to see the three of them together, because that really, you can understand the collectors and their vision. Like, there's a common thread through those three things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious to see how the Donald Judd stack does. It's quite beautiful in person. It's one of the smaller size boxes. It's funny, I came into the view and I actually have two stacks. Right. One's the Corten Steel and then the yellow plexiglass one. But I came in and Peter Ballantyne was there doing his thing.
Amazing. Still at it.
Fresh off the plane from Switzerland. It's coming from Helen Lewis, who was the wife of the entertainment lawyer Marvin Meyer. And, you know, I think it's a later, slightly later example, but I've found minimalism in particular to have been a bit of a slog in the last couple, you know, it's an absolute passion of mine, but the market hasn't necessarily responded to the same taste that I have. Mm-hmm. But I'll be curious to see how this does, because it is a really beautiful example. I also bring up Judd because I've been enjoying all of the Kim Kardashian Donald Judd fiasco going on. Did you take the test in the New York Times?
Of course I did. Yeah, pass with flying colors.
Same.
I'm no Tommy Clements. Come on.
God, I love
that. We'll leave it there.
We'll leave it there. Yeah.
We already got into trouble on that one.
Yeah, we did. Yes, we did.
Yeah, we got it.
Sorry, Kim.
I mean, just because it ain't my world, you're a little bit closer to it. This Dora, this great Picasso. Not great might be overselling it, but I really like this painting of the view. I feel like if you can get this for $12 million in 1939,
yeah, Picasso, I mean, I would say, like,
exactly.
I mean, I think it's a very commercial, very sort of classic Dora painting. Good size, you know. I would say, just because of my specialty, I am asked about a Picasso portrait of a female head like three times a week from clients. It's one of the sort of pictures of the certificate, so it's not in the cat res in the Zervos, but obviously it's got everything. But the one thing I find sometimes with Asian collectors in particular, really want to have the signature on the painting, and sometimes that does sort of throw things off. It's the most ridiculous thing, because a Picasso is Picasso.
But that's the market. The market's the market.
I mean, the only time you signed it was when you sold a painting, and it's just, I find absolutely ridiculous that people can't come to the understanding that it is still a Picasso if it isn't signed on the front.
I mean, it reads like a Picasso from 40 feet away.
Exactly. I mean, if it's that obvious, it shouldn't be an issue. But no, it's a beautiful work. A little bit more subdued tones.
Yeah.
Which sometimes, you know, throws some collectors off. A lot of people like the more bright, more brooding kind of paintings. But I think this one's, you know, got an exceptional kind of aesthetic to it.
And as of yet, unguaranteed, it appears.
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, a lot of these, I'm quite surprised at the number of works that are coming up naked. It'll be...
Yeah, I mean, especially I got to say this, and I gave them a lot of credit at the beginning of this segment, especially Phillips, like they got a consignment of Picasso unguaranteed.
Exactly. And I think what we'll see, and what I found the most disturbing in the London auctions, was just the sheer amount of withdrawals that they did. I mean, it was just, you know, it felt like when the auctioneer used to read off the guarantee list, it was like almost as long as the one that they're doing for the withdrawals. So, you know, the reason they do it is to be able to kind of ideally save face with the collector, but equally they want to be able to sort of, you know, put out to the market their, you know, sold by lot and sold by value.
Yeah, they're past the, but do you think that even, does that register anymore? Because everyone knows what's happening with withdrawals. Like, is anyone tracking that number and be like, oh, this house is doing better, I will consign with them or invest my money with them or what have you? Like, that it feels like a metric that they've taken any meaning away from.
I think if you are just parroting whatever comes out of the auction house press room, it does, it's fine. Like, but if you scratch very, very shallowly below the surface, then you find that, you know, that is a big hamper in terms of the overall.
I just feel like with so much more transparency in general now, both with prices and through the sales themselves, like those kind of old school numbers that they could tout just mean less and less. But I do think it does protect the consigner and that property from the, you know, from having been burned up, yeah, on the up at the rostrum.
I mean, I know they're very against having to withdraw lots. I mean, they would rather take the gamble, at least from a business perspective, because they get money out of it, and it's a sunk cost at that point. They'd rather try and at least.
Yeah, you never know if someone will pop their hand in the air.
Exactly, and I think that's what always annoys me as well. Is like, if you haven't registered enough interest, like a lot of people don't want to be seen as, you know, obviously bidding. They would rather see what's, you know, what's going on.
They want to see that reserve get crushed.
But
I'm a big fan of crushing reserves. Not a big fan of withdrawing. Love to see like a really good day sale where you see where they match some reserves, like even really low to some interest. Like,
yeah,
always makes my heart sing, because you can just imagine those kids up there in that office, like late the night before the day sale, like going through those Excel spreadsheets.
Oof, I'm having
sounds like a blast.
I'm glad I'm not them, but like I want to like show my love and to them doing.
Yeah, there is a lot of things that go in the shadows that you have to do as a specialist, which is not fun. But yeah.
It ain't all premium economy, buddy. I think that was it. And you know what? I fucking love this painting so much. It's so funky.
Yeah, it is. I quite like it as well. And it seems a little obscure for going into the Phillips sale. Not to say that they can't sell it, but I do find when you have these types of paintings, it's a little bit lost within the context of something that most people are coming to for kind of post-war to contemporary. But it's a beautiful rendering, yeah.
I don't know, $600,000.
Yeah.
You know, what else can you get? You know, what else of historical import can you get?
Of course.
A number of things, but still, I like that. That's all I had in the big evening sales, and I decided not to go through with a fine-tooth comb through the day sales, but do you have some stuff that's coming up in some of the other sales
Yeah, I mean, we've got Christie's 20th Century Evening Sale, which we haven't kind of gone through.
Yeah.
Forgot about Century, Benjamin.
I live in the moment. I live in the moment.
So contemporary.
And also, I knew that I could depend on Locke to bring us back to the art that you actually need to know something about. You know, I'm just protecting myself. So yeah, let's start then, or restart then, with that Christie's sale taking place on the 18th. No.
So 17th. The one that sort of immediately jumped out to me is the one that they've used as the cover, which is David Hockney's A Lawn Being Sprinkled. It's from 1967. It's 60 by 60 inches, estimated at $25 to $35 million, both with a guarantee and a third party. Already it's going to be within the sort of top 10 prices for the artist at auction. A Neat Lawn, which was a larger work. It was actually 96 by 96 inches and sold... sold last year for $11 million at Philips. Actually, 2 years ago, so just under the low estimate. But this one, I think, has just so much more presence, despite being smaller. It also has great history. It's coming from the Norman and Lynn Lear collection, which is their kind of, this is the real kind of show pony painting within the collection. The total collection coming up is going to be around $50 million low estimate, and includes Ruscha, Lichtenstein, de Kooning, Rauschenberg, Kelly, a lot more. It's really, you know, I think an outstanding collection. I love, you know, the Ruscha from the collection as well, Truth. It gets another just incredible painting. They've done quite a cool installation for it. I like the wood paneling and everything downstairs. Nice. Hats off to whoever came up with that one. It's really funny too. If you look, the people who owned it before the Lears did, it must have been a gift or bought directly from Ed Ruscha. But on the back, instead of writing the title Truth, it says Rhymes with Tooth.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't clock that. That's incredible.
Yeah. But they had a great eye. I mean, he died. He was 101 years old, and he's obviously the legendary screenwriter, producer, and an activist who produced All in the Family and Sanford and Son. So
you can Jefferson's. Watch some of the TV shows at Christie's.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
Yeah, they did a really, really, really good job.
I think, yeah, it's nice to kind of bring out the actual person behind, you know, the collection, especially for those who kind of have a vague understanding of who they are, but not necessarily the full impact of what they had, especially something like this in television history. Another sort of star lot within the context of the sale is Andy Warhol's Flowers from 1964. It is one of the large flower paintings in that kind of 82 by 82 inch size. The record price was set for a Flowers painting from the Doris and Thomas Amon sale. It was kind of more of a white Flowers. And that sold for, that was 2 years ago, and that sold for $15.8 million. So this is already sort of a step above. It's got that kind of day glow fluorescent paint, and they weirdly show on the website if you put under a black light what it looks like. But it was one of three in the size that were shown at the original Leo Castelli exhibition of the flower paintings. There are nine paintings in this scale from 1964, and one's at the Hirshhorn, one's at the Andy Warhol Museum, one's at the Kaiser Wilhelm Museum in Krefeld. And yeah, so I think it's a beautiful coloration. It's a striking picture. They've lit it quite well, so it looks good in the view and impressive to see.
Yeah, it's a very impressive picture in the view.
And then I would say the Rauschenberg. I really like the beautiful painting called Hawk. Again, Rauschenberg, such a seminal artist to art history, but sometimes doesn't necessarily translate very well, much like Jasper Johns in the auction context. This one is from 1960, beautiful kind of collage, estimated $8 to $12 million. This is coming from the collection of Senator Herb Kohl, former senator. And
a lot of senators consigning works. That's nice.
He was also the owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Ball club.
Yeah. Real, good to see real a passionate boy collector.
Do good.
Yeah. and he acquired it from Allen Stone Gallery in 1974. It's, you know, so rare to get any of these kind of combine paintings, because most of them are museum collections. And the good thing is that all the proceeds are going to his sort of philanthropic passions that he had in his life. So at least kind of continues the senator's legacy. So, and then another work that I wanted to note was 27B, which is the Frank Stella concentric square. It is, you know, striking image. If you coming up at $6 to $8 million, and it's guaranteed. This is the 70s painting. So he started these in the 1960s. This is from 1974. The provenance lists my former gallery in it. I actually, this is one of the first paintings I got in. It was originally in the Essel collection in Vienna, which is a beautiful, large contemporary museum just outside of Vienna. At the time, Karl-Heinz Essel was having, he was the owner of this sort of DIY market chain called Bomax, and it was having some issues. He had, you know, an incredibly robust collection, and I was able to kind of sneak in and sort of go through the racks and do a little bit of picking of choice. This was one of them.
And who had he worked with on assembling this museum collection?
I can't remember. He's had curators, obviously, in the sort of early days of putting it all together, but it was quite expansive. He started really just focusing on sort of Austrian artists like Unterwasser, and then kind of expanded his vision into more, you know, European and American aesthetics, but it ranged from sort of great pop to German polka Richter to Alex Katz. So it was a little over the map, but what was nice was he tended to buy in depth. So he would have, you know, three or four pictures by a specific artist to kind of be able to build out a show around them. And it was sad. I mean, you could tell these are really his babies, and the last thing he wanted to do was have to sell them, but he needed to kind of keep the museum going. And then
I could be wrong, but I remember that I think that David Zwirner's dad had a little bit of a hand, especially in introducing some of the pulp works into that collection.
Potentially, that would make sense.
I think so, but yeah. I'm not totally certain.
No, that would make sense. And I think he, you know, you see him always at the art fairs. He's, you know, but I would say that thankfully the Albertina, I believe, stepped in and was able to actually save the museum, take it into the collection. So it's still sort of a great sort of functioning museum today. And then another one that has a close personal touch to me is Franz Klein's Washington Wall. I absolutely love this painting, painted in 1959. It's coming up at $10 to $15 million, not guaranteed. It is part of a group called the Vital Line, a New York collection, which I managed to figure out who that is, but I can't say on the podcast. But it encompasses Leger, David Smith, Noguchi, Martin Puryear, Gustin, Calder. And this painting was originally purchased in November 2005 at Christie's for $5,448,000. And it was, at the time, the second highest price paid for a work by Klein. The record price was set in May of that year for a painting called Crow Dancer, which I remember very well because I was one of those. I was very, very junior at Christie's at the time. And they had me standing in the back, and I was one of those guys that like points at whoever for Christopher Burge to see.
You were a bit spotter.
And you know, it was Larry Gagosian bidding, and it was just, I look like such a dork.
Pay $150 for a picture of that. Maybe 175.
But yeah, I remember I loved Crow Dancer so much that I ended up like going home and making a copy of it myself in my really tiny kitchen in my railroad apartment. Yeah.
That's really cool.
I have to say, like starting off at Christie's, I had, you know, they kind of assume you're a Nepo baby working there because they pay you absolutely nothing. I started out managing a restaurant just to pay my bills, and my mother gave me probably the greatest gift ever, which was she gave me enough money for 1 month's rent in New York and said, figure the rest of your life out. So I had to work like two jobs.
What restaurant?
It's so embarrassing to say. I can't even. It's close to here. It was two blocks away from here. So
on Irving.
No, it wasn't anything. I'm not gonna lie. It was called Mumbles, and it was basically like Cheers with like food in it. And
that sounds great.
It was like wonderful. Literally like you had to like furniture. Like the people that were at the bar were like furniture. Like you just knew they were there every day. You'd get all the stories. But I was making more money at the restaurant than I was at Christie's. And when I got the job, I was an assistant in the trust, estates, and appraisals department. So I kept both jobs and was working Saturday through Tuesday nights and then Monday to Friday at Christie's. And did that for 2 full years, and it was a little exhausting, but definitely a mind and stamina I don't have anymore.
Character building. I love to hear
it. Exactly. But no, it was, you know, I, it was such a sort of seminal moment because this was kind of right when I started. And I was in, as I said, the Trust Estates and Appraisals Department as an assistant. But what it allowed me to do, and one of the great places to start in an auction house, is that you get to work with every single department in the company. And you really get a sense of who everyone is. And at that time, it was a much more diverse departments. You had musical instruments and all these other, Indian miniatures and prints and multiples. And I loved it so much. But my boss very much knew that my trajectory was to try and get into the post-war and contemporary art department. And one of the first estates that came, it wasn't even an estate at that point, was Edward Broida's. Edward Broida owned this Klein Washington wall, and this was part of his sort of single owner collection. And he was the really famous, really, he was an LA real estate mogul. He retired at 40 and basically just focused on collecting. He had more than 700 works in his collection. And what I really liked about Broida's eye was that he would buy super in-depth certain artists. I mean, he had an incredible eye for sort of single pictures. So that sale had, anything from Brancusi's Kiss, the plaster one. He had Guston's early abstract work called Zone. He had David Smith's Jurassic Bird. He had Rothko's Hommage à Matisse, which set the record price at the time for Rothko. And interestingly, with that painting, it was on like semi-permanent loan at, I believe it was the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. And I must have been like the second month I was working there, I had to call the registrar and tell them that it was coming off the wall.
Oh my God.
And then I had to arrange to get it to Christie's in a week. I had to arrange for have an armed security guard like go with it. It was like the wildest, like, push into the deep end working at Christie's. But it was an incredible, incredible group. And Broida had terminal cancer. So instead of just sort of waiting for his estate to kind of take care of everything, he proactively created a selection of works that would come to auction to kind of help fund everything in terms of the estate. And then the rest of it was all being donated to MoMA. And not only did I get to, work with all the pieces in that collection, but we also got to do a lot of the valuations for MoMA and for the estate appraisal, which was just incredible. So, but that, to kind of put it in perspective, that evening sale was $157 million. And that was, back in 2004. That at the time was the highest total for any contemporary art sale.
Wow.
And only 4 of the 70 lots went unsold. There were record prices for 18 artists, including Rothko. But what I really...
Great way to start your career.
It was pretty insane, I'm not going to lie. But what I really liked, too, was that of the artists you really collected in depth was Guston, Selmans, and Ken Price. And my love affair with both Guston and Selmans in particular kind of came because Laura Paulson was she was the one kind of overseeing everything. And she really brought these works to life because she worked at McKee before that. And he had this incredible piece by Selmans, which were, I think it was assortment of 5 different types of rocks. And then you had the exact copy of the rocks that were done in bronze, cast bronze, which she painted. And you couldn't tell. And we spent half an hour arguing between each other which one was the actual rock and which one was the painted one. Wow. It was insane.
Wow.
But amazing collection. And it was just one of those absolute treats to be able to kind of be a part of.
Speaking of McKee, I think it's a really strong Philip Guston painting.
Yes.
Steps that is coming up in the same sale. Just this great foot picture. Like, it has maybe not everything you want in Guston, but in terms of Guston at that scale and what's available on the market, I think this is like a special, special picture at $6 million.
And that's, I think a lot of these, despite the difficulties of getting works in, I find some of the estimates are sort of bucking off of recent auction record prices. But then on the flip side, there are a lot of works that are out there that have been put in at reasonable levels that I feel make sense for the market and make sense for the moment. Because I don't think we can all admit that this isn't 2 years ago. This isn't, you know, there has been a definite dip in terms of sort of engagement at a level above, let's say, $1, $2 million. And anything that's, you know, above 10 gets even thinner, and 20 even thinner for that. So I think overall, you know, there are some big things dangling out there, but for the most part, there's a lot of really great deals. And having been through a couple of these cycles, having been there on the other side of 2008, if I had tons of money in that November 2008 sale, you know, I could have put together the most incredible collection, you know. And it's, I think overall, though, we're just seeing this uncertainty because we haven't seen a crash, but we haven't seen anything else that's sort of resembling a, you know, a window out.
Be fearful when others are greedy, and be greedy when others are fearful. I believe that's the investing phrase.
Yeah.
And I don't mean just financial investing, but opportunity to get things you won't be able to get otherwise. And, you know, this is also from, this Gustin is also from that Vital Line New York collection. And I mean, great provenance, I mean, directly from Gustin to his primary dealer, and been in the same collection since 1982. So super fresh. It's been exhibited in, I think, just two museum exhibitions. Well, just really one, but a travel to four institutions, to SF MoMA, the Corcoran, the Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art, Denver Art Museum, and the Whitney Museum. So five institutions, but still, I mean, it hasn't really been seen. Love this painting. Anything that we missed in here? And it's a big sale. This is going to be, it's going to be a long night.
It's a long one. And the thing I don't quite understand is why the various, you know, especially Christie's kind of taking in all of these things that are outside of the scope of what is normally an auction, when you already have a fairly robust in the idea of the amount of lots you've got. Like, it's exhausting sitting through these sales, and then to throw in like a Richard Avedon, which doesn't necessarily need to be in there, throwing in an Uli figure from Papua New Guinea. I get the kind of context of the collection it was in, but it just seems like they're pushing these things unnecessarily into the context of an evening sale. I mean, obviously we sold dinosaurs and F1 cars before.
Yeah, but it was, like, you know, that was when it was kind of exciting and a one-off and it felt new and fresh, but now it just feels like it's just filler, but it's such a large sale. I mean, it doesn't...
Yeah, you kind of lose a little bit of sight, and I think that's what we've seen in the past, especially when we do have a large collection. But, you know, I think overall, it's, you know, I would like them to kind of focus a little bit more in terms of the you know, what they can get in, rather than to scramble to look like you've got a lot of lots.
I mean, it's still going to be an exhausting week for everybody, least of all the specialists. Nate, are you going to planning on attending any sales this season? Are you covering them?
I think I'll attend one or two. I'm not doing the full gamut because I don't really have to, but definitely a few.
I mean, now that you can watch them on TV, I think there's so much more if you're professional and you're trying to figure out who's bidding on what and the vibe of the market. Although with so much on the phones, you can kind of, you can catch that from your living room just as easily if you know who tends to bid
exactly
with who, and you can make best guesses. There's so little, or there has been at least the past 5 years, but really especially the past two, so little room bidding.
Truly.
Not a big advantage. I think unless you're planning to bid, and whether you're bidding on the phone or raising your hand publicly, I do think it feels good to be in the room, just to get the sense of tempo and rhythm and stuff, especially at the higher numbers. But I'll probably attend all of like the ultra contemporary and 21st century sales. Just to get to feel the vibe, to feel how the market feels.
Sure.
I mean, although as I often argue, I'll definitely go and sit in the back of a couple of day sales for a couple hours and kibitz with people, whether or not I'm bidding. Because like, that's where you really get a feel for
you
the market.
You really get the sense
you
of the market.
You see who's
there
doing these little side deals in the back, who like brings over the phone. Oh, I saw you were bidding on this. I get 6 years of my collection.
Side snacks.
What do you want to buy?
Side snacks.
Yeah. So you know, they serve coffee. You know, that's like a, you know, an exhausting but good afternoon. You know, and we also have two, you know, moderate size fairs. This week we have the Independent, which has been, you know, I believe it's its 15th year anniversary. Our friend Joel Messler is going to be painting some portraits on the ground there once again, reprising a performance he did, quote unquote, early in his career.
Same price too.
Yeah, I always find Tibbetts in the Independent, like, you know,
sure.
You know, that's where I've been first introduced a number of things, and like I think TAFAF is like New York is like a very small fair but so tasteful. Gonna go eat some oysters at the Vernissage for sure.
I love TAFAF.
TAFAF's great.
Yeah, no, it's a great experience.
Yeah.
But New York feels alive. I like it. You know, it's buzzy walking around the fair.
Good luck getting dinner reservations, man.
Yeah, it's nuts right now, which is great. I mean, this is what I want to see.
I'm surprised you didn't have, I guess you had the reunion weekend, but you know, Miami F1, that's kind of up your alley now.
Thing, yeah.
I know. had an invite to, but yes. Yeah.
You missed Carbone Beach again.
Yeah, Carbone Beach looked, I'm sorry, Nate, looked so washed. The pictures they posted of who was there. I mean, some of the greatest Americans, but like, I don't want to be having dinner with
Ken Griffin and Elon Musk.
And DJ Soul, the Goldman Sachs, David Solomon.
Oh, yeah.
David Solomon was there. Yeah, it was quite the same.
But all looking kind of sweaty and disheveled, they posted these pictures. It was like, I don't know. To me, it was really gnarly looking. Anything that you're excited about this week? I'm not even sure if we're going to post this in time. Don't worry about it. Don't answer.
I think that's it, Locke. Thank you so much for once again coming on the podcast and just sharing your knowledge.
We keep going. We can hit the 2-hour mark. I'm just saying.
Yeah, exactly.
We've never hit the 2-hour mark. This is true. But I think that we've dispensed with enough wisdom for today.
It's also 900 degrees in this office with the window closed. I'm dying over here. Locke. I say this every time. Thank you so much. This is always truly super edifying for me, and I presume the listeners as well, but I don't care as much about them.
No, it's a great experience, and I always love coming here and seeing you guys. And you know, it's fun for me as well because I get to take the time to really study the sales and have an in-depth look at it a little bit more than most people have to. So,
all right, good luck out there in the sales rooms, everybody. That's it from us. Nota bene.
Out.